Good morning. House Education Finance Committee will come to order. Thank you, members. I appreciate you being here on a Friday when we're not usually having committee meetings. But we do have a number of bills that we still want to hear yet this week, so that's what we're doing, and hopefully we'll get through them in fairly expeditious fashion. Representative Detmer, would you like to move the minutes of our last meeting, April 9th?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move April 9th meetings.
All right. Any questions or comments on the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the minutes of April 9th, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? No. Nope. All right, minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Detmer. And Representative Lucero, you are up first. All right, Representative Lucero, I will go ahead and move your bill, House File 983, to be re-referred to Ways and Means, but it is my intention to lay it over today for possible inclusion in a later bill. And with that, please go ahead and explain your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will actually begin by, if I could, turn it over to research. My understanding is that there was not a packet, a summary put together. So.
Yes, Mr. Strom, if you want to just kind of explain the bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Lucero, my apologies on the summary today. Oh, a little behind. House File 983 is a bill that creates a new general education disparity aid. There's essentially a qualifying factor and then a formula to give that aid. And the qualifying factor essentially is a measure of the school district's property tax base per pupil, and it measures it both ways. As these, as members of this committee are familiar, we have two tax bases in the K-12 area. We have the adjusted net tax capacity, which levies like the debt service levy are spread against, and we have the referendum market value, which is our tax base for operating referendum. And referendum market value excludes the ag lands and the seasonal rec properties, so we get a very different distribution of district property wealth by looking at ANTC versus referendum market value. What this bill does is qualify a district if its tax base on either of those measures is less than or equal to the 20th percentile. By way of comparison for you on the referendum market value, the statewide average amount per pupil is $487,000 right now. The 20th percentile would be a district with a referendum market value of about $271,000 per pupil. For an adjusted net tax capacity measure, that's the tax base that includes all the classes of property, the statewide average is about $7,500 per pupil. The 20th percentile would be $5,068 per pupil. So the qualifying factor for the bill is that you're low tax base on what, at least one of those two measures. Then the revenue calculation is essentially a percentage of the difference between where the individual district is at and the 20th percentile. For all those districts lower than 20th percentile on general education revenue, the amount that they would get is the difference between the 20th percentile and their district's revenue, and 70% of that would go to the district. So, for example, if a district's general education revenue were about $7,000 per pupil and the 20th percentile were at $7,500, that difference, the $500, the district would get 70% of that, or $350 per pupil. The closer you get to the 20th percentile, the more that phases out, the smaller the revenue. The further you are from the 20th percentile, the greater the revenue. So again, my apologies for not having a printout ready for you today, but that's the mechanism and how the aid would be calculated under House File 983.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. That was a very good explanation. We appreciate that. Any questions for Mr. Strom? Representative Crescia.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Strom, so whatever that dollar amount would be, that would have to be that's money we just couldn't shift. That would have to be added to the target. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, yes. This is an additional spending item. No one's revenue would be reduced due to this bill, but those that are below the 20th percentile would get additional state aid. So it would be an additional amount of funding.
Representative Crescia.
And just quickly, do we have an approximation of how many districts that might be?
Madam Chair, I don't have that currently. I'm guessing it's around 15% of the districts. The 20th percentile means that if all the low-revenue districts were low tax base on one measure or another, the maximum amount it could be is 20% of the districts. But there are some low-revenue, high tax base districts out there. So I'm guessing somewhere between 10 and 15% of the districts. And the closer you are to the 20th percentile, the smaller the aid. So there will be some districts that will get very small amounts of aid.
Representative Crescia.
And one more small question. Thing. So as I think of districts around the state, again, example at my area, could there be disparity like we have Brainerd, Minnesota, and then just not very far away from that, like in an Aiken County? Would this create, with the open enrollment, would this create disparities in regions like that? Do you see a situation like that?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, the reason general education revenue differs by school district is for those factors such as sparsity and compensatory, those kinds of things. Those are the primary reasons that revenue among districts varies. So what this bill would do is pull up a district that has very low amounts of those revenues more toward the where the 20th percentile district is at. And as a result of that, I'm guessing that it's fairly small amounts of revenue on the margin for most districts and would probably not lead to much behavioral change. In other words, the district that's getting this money would be able to provide a more enhanced program, but the relative size of that adjustment is probably small enough not to encourage much behavioral change, kids switching from one district to another that otherwise would not be doing so.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Strom, Madam Chair, Mr. Strom, would those border cities that we talked about over by South Dakota, would they be negatively or positively or unaffected?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, Ms. Johnson and I'll see if we can get a list together for the committee for the next time we meet on this. But in general, the border cities like the Browns Valleys and Alberta Chocayas and those kinds of districts tend to be relatively modest to high revenue districts because they've got some special characteristics, often eligible for sparsity. A district like Browns Valley, for example, has a large number of students eligible for free and reduced lunch, so they wouldn't fit into the 20th percentile. So my guess is that most of those districts would be unaffected. Ms. Johnson's getting the fiscal note printed for us, and the department's analysis of this looked like 23 districts qualified, so about 5%. So I was overly generous in thinking it was more like 10 to 15%. Looks like 5% of the districts or thereabouts are qualifying.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Erickson.
Well, Madam Chair, I was just going to note the sheet, the handout that Ben had brought to Mr. Withers. That is what the Senate, I think, produced when Senator Kiffmeyer had this bill heard in the Senate. And so we'll get copies of it. It shows the districts.
Thank you very much. Our very able page, Ben, will make sure that we have the information. Thank you. All right. If there's no other questions for Mr. Strom, I think we'll go ahead to you, Representative Lucero, and any testifiers you have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will just give my brief opening remarks here, and then I'll call up some testifiers. Education is extremely important to all of us. Ensuring opportunities exist for our children is what will best prepare our children for the demands of the careers of the future. So school districts have a unique challenge. School districts have unique challenges with which categoricals in the existing funding formula attempt to recognize and assist with funding. And it is also recognized that these unique challenges experienced by the districts will naturally result in greater funding for some districts over others. However, the unintended consequence of the existing funding formula is the creation of an increasingly growing disparity gap for those districts that are at the bottom. Local referendums disproportionately impact people living in the bottom 20% of the districts statewide because they are largely bedroom communities and or agricultural. They don't have the business or industrial base to tax when it comes to referendums, so it creates a hardship that's, again, disproportionate. My file, House File 983, seeks to help low-revenue, low-tax-based districts by targeting the bottom 20%, which was explained by Mr. Strom. The revenue is a categorical revenue. The funding for the program would come from the state general fund, and the bill has no effect on the higher revenue districts. I was not seeking to take away from anybody, simply assist those at the bottom. HF 983 has bipartisan support, and as you will see here, the runs have been done, and it is 21 districts, and it will bipartisanly support districts as well. And with that, Madam Chair, I do have a few testifiers, and I will call the board.
All right. Welcome. And if each of you would just state your full name into the record before you give your remarks, that will help us with our record keeping. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. School districts with more money clearly have ability to provide higher quality, broader, deeper opportunities for students that they serve. As one of the lowest funded school districts, St. Michael Elberville must rely upon the basic education dollars that it receives to meet the needs of specific or special needs students, because we do not qualify for categorical aid, or for, if we do, at very low levels. This becomes even more challenging for school districts like ourselves that do not have the tax base to levy for larger amounts of revenue. It just becomes cost prohibitive to our taxpayers. At St. Michael Elbertville, we do have the local option revenue and our board approved levy of $300, so we are equaling $724 for of that revenue. That's the maximum we would have for that additional local revenue. But however, that pays for our special ed cross subsidy. It pays for our basic skills programs that are not funded through categorical aid or because we get such at lower levels. Those as such as compensatory programs, English language programs, extended time programs. And it's also, and then the balance of it is used in response to, through the last six years particularly, where there was very small or no increases in the basic formula, just to maintain our existing programs. I fully understand that over the next few weeks there'll be much debate about how best to spend a significant budget surplus. However, ensuring that all students receive adequate funding for basic education can be addressed by this bill for spending as little as $10 million per year distributed among the 21 school districts. So House File 983 addresses that need, quite frankly, to just do the bottom adequate funding for all school districts, and in our case, just to maintain our existing programs. I want to have my time that we have available today to two students from St. Michael Elbertville that have worked with us very closely on our legislative action this year. They are Madeline Jesser and Brianna Goodchild, and I'll let them introduce themselves and speak. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Madeline Jesser, and I am a senior at St. Michael Elbertville High School. I'm very involved in a variety of extracurricular activities, and I'm also dedicated to my studies. Now, I've always felt very blessed to go to STMA. I feel that it's a wonderful community to be a part of. But about a year ago, I began expanding out and meeting students from other districts, and I began to notice a common trend among all of these students, and it's that almost all of them have a lot more opportunities provided to them than the students at my school. And, you know, why is that? Well, I'm learning that it's because we simply have inadequate funding for our students to provide these types of opportunities. And so myself and many of my peers are missing out on many valuable opportunities and experiences. So the first place where I see that happening is on the upper end of the spectrum in terms of students, the students who are taking AP courses. Now, a school 20 miles down the road from us is able to provide their students 27 AP courses to choose from. Our school is only able to offer 9. Now, for me as a student, this is a huge missed opportunity for me. There are classes that I would like to take, but our school simply can't afford to offer. So now I'm going to have to make up for that next year in college. I'm going to have to personally pay to take those classes, whereas I could have possibly taken them in high school. So right there, that's a large missed opportunity for myself and many of my peers. Now, the other side where I see effects of this low funding would be the other side of the spectrum, the students who are in need of a little bit of extra help, possibly through remedial programs. Now, I have been a tutor for several years, and I am currently an aide for a math class with students who are a bit challenged with the subject. And it just breaks my heart to see students who want to succeed not have the resources to, and to struggle a bit. So wouldn't it be awesome if we could afford to hire extra professionals to come in and help these students and give them what they need to succeed and what they truly deserve? Now, no matter what end of the spectrum students are on, we see major missed opportunities in our arts department. In our music department, we have 2.5 teachers to 525 students. That's almost 1/3 of our student body. Clearly, not enough teacher one-on-one time with these students, and missed opportunities. Students are being held back from their full potential in the music department. Same with our fine arts. 3.5 teachers to over 1,000 students. And teachers have even had to go to the extent of paying up to $500 out of pocket to pay for art supplies to give to our students. There's even a teacher who has to dumpster dive to find supplies for the art classrooms. So clearly, many missed opportunities for those students. Now, in terms of technology in our arts department, their document cameras are kind of a new thing for students to use and teachers to use in photography. Now, we aren't able to afford those, and we've had to even go out into the community and ask our own community members, our own taxpayers, for more money through fundraisers and things like that. So regardless of what side of the spectrum students are on, we all feel these effects of the low funding, and ultimately it's missed opportunities for our students, and it's something that we can't fix through a fundraiser. It's something that we truly need your help with. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Jesser.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, as popular author Rick Riordan once said, fair isn't everyone getting the same thing. Fair is everyone getting what they need. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak to you this morning. I am Brianna Goodchild, and I am here on behalf of St. Michael Albertville High School. Today, my plan is to show you through my experiences and those of my classmates how we are being negatively impacted by this current funding system. I mainly plan to focus on class size, counseling, and school activity impacts. As I've gotten older, the class sizes at my school have been increasing steadily. And when we have class sizes in the upper 30s, we can see that there simply is not enough time for teachers to give individualized attention to each of their students. I know I've gone into my classes many times early in the morning, trying to get more help or clarification on different issues. But my teacher's classroom is always full of other students trying to do the same, which makes it nearly impossible for me to get extra help from my instructor when I desperately need it. What we can see is that when we have class sizes this large, it becomes nearly impossible for us to get the individualized attention that we need. And we can see that when we are denying funding for more teachers and more class sizes, well, ultimately, students are being denied access to their education. High school is a very difficult time for students, and we can see that because of this, counseling is such a crucial issue. At our school, we have 3 amazing counselors, but they are in charge of 1,600 students. Currently, we are asking each of our counselors to be in charge of over 500 hormonal teenagers' class schedules, mental and emotional health, as well as their college preparation. We can see that we are giving them a heavy burden, which is simply an unfair thing for us to ask. When students are as vulnerable as they are in high school, we can see how essential it is for us to get more counselors, because without them, we're being denied guidance that will help us prepare for the rest of our lives. The different activities at my school have also suffered greatly from these funding issues. Our programs are being forced to rely on outside support in our community, such as donations and even booster clubs. As different programs in my school continue to grow and grow, the advisory staff isn't. When there aren't enough advisors to meet the demand for these students, we can see that students aren't getting the attention that they need from their coaches, and they're not able to improve as easily as they would otherwise. This is ultimately affecting our opportunities, and what we can see is that we are being denied access to these different things because of this funding issue. And when activity involvement is so strongly correlated with academic success, we can see how critical it is for us to be given these opportunities. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like again to thank you for your time today, and I hope that you please give my school what it needs.
Thank you very much, Ms. Goodchild. To both of the students, you're very well spoken, and you've done a great job, so thanks for being with us today. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I will call in it.
Before the superintendent leaves, I just had a quick question, and I am looking at this the spreadsheet showing the districts that would be affected in that. And I can see, obviously, the referendum market value per pupil unit, and your district appears to be sort of at the bottom. But I'm just curious, has your district attempted a referendum of going out to the taxpayers? And is that, I'm assuming that has not been successful, if you have.
Madam Chair, I can clarify that. We have had a referendum of $695. And then with the recalculation that's taking place with the new funding mechanisms, and then with the option for the board to levy the additional $300, that's where we're up to the $724.
Right. Thank you.
I think the state average at this point in time is somewhere $1,000 to $1,100.
Thank you. Representative Crescia.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and to the superintendent, thank you very much for coming. Would you support, if we were to give you and your school board more ability to increase that levy amount without going to the voters? How would you see that, as an advantage or a disadvantage?
You know, as a superintendent, I'm always a little anxious speaking for my school board. But I would say that the fact that we were able to use an additional $24 a pupil through the board approved, and they were willing to do that. Our board is going to be faced, as we projected out, for the next 2 to 3 years, we're going to be looking at somewhere between $1 million to $2 million deficits, and that we will have to cut from our program. So they'll be easily faced with that. So I think any flexibility and opportunities to look at those options would be certainly greatly appreciated. I think why this bill is one way to address this disparity in funding. Certainly, I've been here before your committee and talked about expanding the equity, the metro equity formula, and there's been bills to expand that across the whole state. So I think there's many options for looking at how to address schools who are the low property value and low revenue, and this is certainly one of them.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I think we can move to your next testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next testifier is the superintendent from Farmington.
Each one is.
All right, welcome. And again, if each of you would just state your full names for the record. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jay Haugen. I'm superintendent of schools for the Farmington Area Public Schools. So Farmington is a growing district, a low property wealth district, but one which has pulled together to build facilities to meet that growth. Because of this, we are in the top five statewide for the highest local property tax due to the schools. That's the burden on our taxpayers. I believe last time I looked, we were number three in the state. And this is true, even though we have zero voter-approved operating levy to support educational programming. Our current high property tax rate and the large tax impact even a small levy requires in our district makes asking for even a modest operating levy, a levy which has become basic funding for most other school districts, a large burden for our community. In the last 5 years, even as we have added 600 students, we have cut custodians, cut secretaries, cut paraprofessionals, cut counselors, cut administrators, cut programs, and, of course, raised class size. Our neighboring districts, comparison districts, who are not in our circumstance, routinely receive $10,000 to even $20,000 more per classroom as we. Our students compete with their students. The disparity aid bill before you will bring Farmington $125 more per pupil, or about $3,000 more per classroom. And while we will still be at the lowest 20% for funding, this added revenue will help us close the gap, provide a slightly more level playing field, allowing our community's maximum effort to bring us at least within sight of most of our comparison school districts, helping us provide a true Minnesota education to our students and for our community. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Haugen. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charlie Blesner. I'm the Director of Community Engagement for District 728, the Elk River Area Schools. We are the eighth largest district in the state of Minnesota We serve about 67,000 lifelong learners, about 13,000 of which are enrolled in our K-12 programs. We have schools operating in Elk River, Rogers, Zimmerman, and Otsego, Minnesota. We operate 9 elementary schools, 4 middle schools, and 4 senior high schools, and 2 early ed centers. We're a mission-driven district. We have a citizen-driven strategic plan, which is in front of you, a one-pager, that includes strategies, core values, a mission statement, and results that we hold ourselves to every year. We're ending the third year of that strategic planning process, and every 5 years we will renew that with new result statements. We work very hard to connect with our communities and our families and in our businesses, and we're continuously looking for ways to improve how it is that we deliver our instruction. Every member of our staff is involved in a professional learning community. Our schools have alternative schedules within their day to accommodate remediation and what is called response to intervention, RTI, making sure that kids who don't get our initial high-quality instruction are remediated. Those that get it and are ready to excel are able to also do that within the context of our normal school day. Our problem is that we are a very low property district. We're a poster child for this bill. Currently, our district revenue per student lags behind the state average by $853 per student, behind the 7-county metro average by $1,029. If we had either of those, if we were equal to the state average or equal to the 7-county metro average, we would have anywhere from $10 to $13 million more per year, over and above our current roughly $130 million operating budget. So we're a property poor district, but yet we do really good work. Just a few of our things that we're doing incredibly well. Elk River District 728 is the home of 2015's Mr. Hockey and the USA Today Player of the Year. His name is Jake Jaremko. We also are host to Jordan Hack, who is the 2015 Minnesota Math League state champion. He beat 2,700 other mathematicians. We are home to one of the 10 state finalists for Minnesota's Teacher of the Year, Kathy Oberg, a first grade teacher at Otsego Elementary. And our culinary arts team has won the second state championship in a row, and their instructor has been nominated for a national award. I will turn the mic over to Greg Hine, our Director of Business Services, who will get into the nitty-gritty of the money.
Hi, I'm Greg Hine, Executive Director of Business with Elk River Area School District. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thanks for entertaining us today. Eric asked that we keep our testimony short, so in that vein, I'm going to save 1,000 words by providing a picture that you should have. And we know that pieces of legislation are drafted to address specific needs for school districts, but when you add it all together, Elk River shows that this, as this graph shows, at the bottom of the poll. It's not just one thing, it's a combination of things. In terms of compensatory revenue, we have nearly 3,000 learners from low-income families. However, they're not concentrated in any specific area, so yet they still have the same learning needs and issues as their counterparts, but we don't get the funding for that. We're not considered metro for equity revenue purposes. While a basic formula increase is great for everybody, that actually standalone widens this disparity gap. In terms of the referendum, as Charlie said, we're a very property poor district. On top of that, we have very large debt because we're growing and expanding. We just passed a $98 million building construction to handle the overcrowding at some of our schools. So it puts a real large burden on the property taxpayers. They did also pass an operating levy up to the maximum amount that we could go before it became 100% property tax. So I feel that our taxpayers have made maximum local effort, and we're seeking some state assistance to help us close this equity gap. We compete in our labor contracts for the top teachers, administrators, professionals with the metro market. We buy a lot of our services from metro companies, and we're embarking on a huge construction binge here, and that we're going to be using a lot of metro construction companies. So we compete in that market. We also compete for students, and with the funding at the levels they are now, We do the basics, and we do them extraordinarily well. Our test scores stack up against anybody's. But in terms of offering that enhanced student experience that's going to require for 21st century learners to be successful, we're seeking some additional funding so that we can round that out. Not being able to offer that, as was mentioned, is infringes on our competitive ability to attract and retain our own students. So we lose some students as a result of that, which further exacerbates the revenue problem. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hine. We appreciate you all being here. Any questions for these testifiers? Representative Grisha?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One quick question, and I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Greg Hine.
You mentioned your test scores, and you're very competitive around the state. So more dollars would make your test scores go higher?
Mr. Hine.
It would allow us to offer additional programming for in some of our curricular areas and possibly enhance our core classroom, so that I would expect that our test scores would continue to improve because we have such high quality professionals employed in our district.
Other questions? All right, seeing none, thank you. Do you have any other additional testifiers?
Madam Chair, I have no additional testifiers. I'll just give my closing remarks.
All right, thank you.
And that is, Madam Chair, I will just stress, and Representative Creech has a good point, it's not necessarily more dollars will equal greater test scores, but what more dollars will help with is greater opportunities. And it is opportunities such as various languages, world languages being taught. It's opportunities such as the arts or musical, AP courses, et cetera. And those opportunities are limited with limited dollars, again, due to the property poor districts. And I, again, want to emphasize that this is targeting those who, the residents of those districts, the burden of raising money falls disproportionately because there isn't the tax base of industry or other businesses in the area. It's largely bedroom communities. So, Madam Chair, I appreciate the indulgence of yourself and the committee. And I appreciate your consideration of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. And with that, I'll renew my motion, and House Bill 983 is laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you very much. Thank you to all our testifiers, and especially our students.
Thank you.
Are any of you on debate or speech team? Yes, I thought maybe. You did you did very well.
We can give them an A+.
Representative Detmer. Representative Detmer, if you want to go ahead and move your bill, and your motion is to move it to Ways and Means, but it is the Chair's intention to lay it over today for possible inclusion in a later bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move House File 498, did you say Ways and Means?
Yes.
And possible inclusion in the Education Omnibus Bill. And Madam Chair, thank you for allowing us to come in and give this testimony. Looking out at the members of the committee here, I was thinking about it when I was coming in this Friday. How many feel that we've been in a marathon so far? And now we're getting into the sprinting part of the session. And serving on different committees and the different bills that are coming across and putting together the omnibus bills, now we're in the sprint mode. But House File 498, in 2010, those that were here in 2010, the Minnesota legislature passed and the Governor Plenty signed into law that required that all school districts include physical education minimum standards component in their curriculum. Representative Norton and I, we worked a long time on that bill, and I worked three sessions on getting those standards in because Minnesota did not have any physical education standards. Members of the Minnesota Health Kids Coalition advocated for this change and helped rising the obesity epidemic that we have in the state across Minnesota and the country, as well in the response to the overwhelming evidence of benefits of physical education in our schools and a comprehensive physical education curriculum. Higher test scores, fewer discipline issues, and healthier kids, it's the evidence is here. And if you take a look at a handout that I have in your packet, I think many of you know that I also promote a lot of our legislation here in the legislature for our military and our veterans. But there's a letter there from our mission readiness. This is a group of generals that are working on the problems that we have in our country today, looking at the number of young people that are actually eligible to enter our military. And if you take a look at that second paragraph there, let me just share that with you. We are gravely concerned about too many Americans. 69% of 17 to 24-year-olds in Minnesota are ineligible to serve in the military, largely due to three factors: poor physical fitness, insufficient education achievement, and a record of crime and drug abuse. The number one medical reason that young people and women who want to serve our nation in uniform cannot join the military because they, like 27% of the Minnesota children, are overweight or obese. And they go on to talk about other issues too. My 25 years in the military, one of my additional duty assignments was a master fitness trainer, working with men and women in the military and helping them with their physical fitness and their PT scores. I have two people here that would like to testify. I have Matt Johnson with Minnesota Shape, and also Matt Schaefer. We got the M&M boys here today with the Minnesota Cancer Society. And if Mr. Johnson would introduce himself.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, for allowing me to speak on this important issue. My name is Matt Johnson. I'm a physical education teacher at Hassan and Rogers Elementary School in the Elk River Area School District. We've been sitting for a little while. I think it might be a good idea just to stand up out of your chair. I invite anybody that would like to go ahead and stand up.
We sit.
Maybe stretch a little bit if you really want to. Marge, get the blood flowing a little bit.
Come on, Joe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Some of us turned right.
You can stand if you wish, Representative.
Now, if you were to come to my class, though, you would be in moderate to vigorous physical activity for the entire class period. And you got a little glimpse of what that felt like. But not only would your body experience the many benefits of exercise, but when you finish physical education class, your brain would be prepared to learn. We have just stimulated the prefrontal cortex of our brain, which improved our mind's alertness, attention, and mood. I saw a lot of smiles. And motivation. We prepared and encouraged our nerve cells to bind to one another, which is a cellular basis for logging in new information. We've also created a substance in our brain, a fairly new finding in brain research called BDNF, which stands for brain-derived neurofactor. John Ratey, a Harvard psychiatry professor and leader in brain research, calls this miracle grow for the brain. Our brains are now in the optimal function. The more fit a student is, the greater the achievement on standardized tests. In a landmark study by the state of California, nearly 1 million 5th, 7th, and 9th graders' results on the fitness tests were compared with SAT scores. There was a direct positive correlation between the degree of fitness and academic test scores. In findings to be published later this year, Dr. Kenneth Cooper of Dallas found the same relationship when comparing the fitness and academic scores of 2.6 million Texas students. The relationship was the same across all ethnic and socioeconomic groups. There have been results in our own backyard as well. At North Trail Elementary in Farmington, for the last 3 years, the PE teachers have conducted an early morning class for struggling readers with remarkable results. The class met for 15 minutes just before the participants' regularly scheduled reading classes. Each session consisted of vigorous games and activities with embedded reading components. Students improved at nearly 5 times the national norm, 3 times as quickly as their peers, and almost doubled the Title I rate. Though the class's duration is winter quarter only, the average gain is nearly 1.25 grade levels in reading. These gains have remained constant in each of the 3 years that has been held. The class is voluntary, but students at North Trail already enjoy physical education on a daily basis, which is not in the norm here in the state of Minnesota. While the other schools in Farmington meet only twice weekly, that too has yielded academic rewards. North Trail students report the highest test scores in the district at all grade levels in both reading and math. In addition, these students make the greatest gains during the testing period. We have a serious problem that needs to be addressed, Representative Detmer already addressed that with the obesity epidemic. As he stated, 27% of our youth in Minnesota, and that's just shy of the national average. National average is over 30%. We're spending $2.8 million here in our state annually, in our nation, $147 billion. And at the root of this obesity epidemic is the decline in physical education and physical activity. Physical education programs have been cut, and our students and our children are not getting enough physical activity outside of the school area. This deeply concerns me and should concern all of us. Quality physical education programs like the one in Naperville, Illinois, have clearly shown to be an effective intervention in what might seem an unstoppable process. Only 3% of ninth graders in Naperville are overweight, where the middle schools have everyday physical education. Compare this with the state of California, ninth grade classes, which are more than 30% overweight. Illinois mandates daily physical education, all grades, where California does not. I'm here today in complete support of the House File 498, and I ask you to support this bill to ensure our students reap the many benefits of a quality physical education. Please keep physical education an integral part of educating the whole child. Thank you. Oh, I did have a handout for you as well. I think it's kind of self-explanatory, but if you do look at the brain scans, it kind of shows before activity, and the cool colors are low activity levels, and of course the active brain has the warmer colors. And if you notice in all of the brain scans, the more physically active, the more active your brain is as well. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I would say probably the brain scan with the red are when we climb the stairs instead of using the elevators here. Mm-hmm. So keep that in mind when you get some exercise climbing the stairs instead of elevators, if you can. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. And I have a couple questions, but I'm going to wait till Mr. Schaefer's done.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I was going to speak briefly on the fiscal note that's been added with House File 498. And the fiscal note is based on the bill as it was introduced. Whenever the bill was heard in the House Education Innovation Policy Committee, it was we put on an amendment really responding to a number of concerns that we'd received from stakeholders on various aspects of the bill, and the intent was to alleviate a number of those. So pieces such as the graduation requirement the two-credit minimum graduation requirements no longer in the bill. The reporting requirement's been changed substantially. And so as you look at the fiscal note,
Mr. Schaefer, we do not have a fiscal note for the House file, so if you could maybe just share with us what the numbers are, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the first biennium, the total cost is $567,000 in the first biennium and then $303,000 in the following biennium, and this is based on the bill as introduced. A portion of that is dealing with the staff resources. The Department of Education has indicated they would need to carry out updating the working with districts to update the benchmarks and standards for physical education. Another portion, the $228,000 that's in the first biennium, would be to pay for a new reporting requirement that's actually no longer in the bill as introduced. In lieu of a new report, the bill seeks to add the evaluation piece into an existing reporting process.
Right. So, Mr. Schaefer, is there a revised fiscal note for what the current has changed or not yet?
Madam Chair, we're not aware of one at that this time. There wasn't one last night.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, so the one that's being run off is the old fiscal note.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Questions from committee members? Representative Murphy.
So if I'm listening to a really exciting mystery murder as I do my 2-mile walk, do I get more red in my brain?
Yes, you do, and you're probably going to figure that mystery out, I would imagine, as you watch the mystery murder.
Okay.
Because your brain will be active, absolutely.
And what about if a person is texting while they're walking or doing something with their little hand like they seem to be doing around here? Does that slow them down or does that make them more active and their brain work better?
Well, I guess we would prefer, Madam Chair, Representative, I guess we would prefer that at least they're walking and not sitting and texting. If we're texting and walking, I don't know how safe it is, but at least we're getting some physical activity.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a question. I have a friend who gets so mad at watching the news that you can see his muscles flexing all of the time. Does that stimulate his brain then, too?
Mr. Johnson.
This is a serious question.
Representative, you know, it would definitely help his increase in strength, probably, because he's flexing his muscles, but we really try to focus on physical activity in physical education class and try to get all our kids active. You know, I think a lot of people have a misperception of physical education, and unfortunately, you probably remember experiences where, you know, it was catered to the athletes and captains, Captain Schaefer, Captain Detmer, we're going to play dodgeball today, nice game last night in the football game, you know, and you guys will be the captains, you pick the teams for the day. And unfortunately, we've just left out almost all of our students. All of our students are sitting on the sidelines. And fortunately, you know, it is moving in the right direction. We're a long ways away from that. And I think this bill will really help. Adopting these standards and these outcomes will help lead us in the right direction as well. And you know, have these profound effects on the test scores, but not only test scores, but the overall health of our students. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Seltzer.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And my questions are not quite as colorful, but anyway. I am very supportive of this. I'm a member of the Bipartisan Childhood Obesity Working Group. But I'm just wondering, just a couple of quantitative questions. Do we anticipate that adopting these new standards will... What do we anticipate that the children will get an hour more exercise a week, or do we have anything quantitative that we're shooting for, or will it simply be by adopting these standards and the rulemaking that follows that physical activity will be more intense, or just how is it going to change if we adopt this?
Mr. Schaefer.
Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer, the intent of the bill in front of you today is really to focus on the quality of physical education that kids are receiving today, really trying to move away from the scenarios that Mr. Johnson explained where you're focusing more on maybe alienating certain populations of the students, and in lieu of that, teaching them life skills that eventually they'll take on into adulthood, and really instead of maybe learning things they're never going to use when they're a little bit older, for example, learning a little bit about cross-country skiing or maybe other rigorous activities that they're going to choose to carry on into their adult lives. Because what the evidence tells us is if people learn healthier physical activity habits when they're younger, they're more likely to carry those out when they get older.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Chair Loon. And so I'm happy to hear that. I'm very happy to hear that. And sometimes, right, quality is better than quantity. In the school district that I represent, they did a study of the amount of time actually spent in each physical education class being active, and they were shocked at the results. So they're also trying to improve the quality of instruction. So thank you.
Madam Chair,
Representative Detmer,
my 34 years in the area of physical education and health education and coaching, one thing that many of the teachers already have adopted the national standards, but what we want is the state to take a look at these national standards and work them for Minnesota and then get them out to those different school districts, and then let the school districts, the teachers, the professionals work with those and develop into their curriculum. And then there's some reporting back to the Department of Education and how they're doing. I know if students learn that it's going to be part of their lifestyle, that they're going to stay physically fit, not just not just when you get all of a sudden turn 30 and find, oh, I'm out of shape, you know. It needs to be part of your lifestyle as you're coming through the different grades, starting at the elementary level. And it could be just getting up out of your desk and moving, even in an English class or a math class, just getting up, stretching, moving, then getting back to your academic work. This can be adopted in all the classes. But your specialists, your certified teachers are there to help other teachers, especially in the elementary. I still do some subbing. And when I go in, I'm K-12 certified, but my whole career was in the secondary. And I remember 7 years ago, my first subbing job, I went in and did a Columbus Elementary School in my district. I started with kindergarten, physical education, all the way to fifth grade for one day. That's a challenge, I tell you. That's a challenge. I was home. I was laying on the couch. My wife said, "What's wrong with you?" I said, "Hats off to the elementary teachers." And it's the lifestyle, making it part of your daily routine. And all my years in the military, there's things I had to do, and as I retired from that and continued on teaching and coaching, I tried to encourage students to stay active in their life. And one of my courses I taught was the outdoor education course: canoeing, water safety, orienteering, and winter survival, snow caving, all the activities that students, and cycling, all the activities that kids like to do, that they, as they get into adulthood. And these are types of things we need schools to take a look at our standards and say, yeah, we can do these things. We might have to make some adjustments. I know not all schools have seven electives like the school that I left in Forest Lake, and plus the required courses. This bill does not require or mandate credits to graduate. I mean, most schools have at least one credit in health and phy-ed for graduation. Some schools have more. But local control is important with this issue, too. But it needs to be part of your lifestyle. I'm very passionate about it, and I think if you talk to any physical education teacher, they're very passionate about it. In fact, Mr. Johnson, when he first came in, I said, "Well, you're a wrestler, aren't you?" "No, he's a basketball player, point guard, you know." But he looks like a wrestler. But I kidded him about that. But I really feel that this is something I think our schools can adopt. We've made some lot of language changes to meet what people wanted from the different organizations, from the superintendent's organization, the building principals, and also the different people that had an interest in this, and we feel we have the language where it can go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Crescia.
Madam Chair, I have to ask. Representative Detmer, I support this bill, but I have to ask because I go back to my elementary days. Will this increase or decrease the amount of square dancing that happens? And you don't need to answer that.
Oh, hey. Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, one of the courses I taught was ballroom dancing, believe it or not. And my college wrestling coach made us, all the wrestlers, take ballroom dancing, all the dance courses in college. And I thought I'd never have to use that when I got into teaching, but I ended up teaching ballroom dancing, about 12 different dances. And it's a great exercise, too. You're moving.
Representative Mulry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a serious question. Remembering high school, and you're in the military, we never had any gym, but we had every day we had an hour of marching. Is that similar? Since you're in the military,
Madam
you
Chair, Representative, yeah, marching, I've done plenty of that, and I know when my sons at West Point, when they were caught doing something they weren't supposed to do, they had to be in the square marching under the lights at night, hours at a time. So just walking, I mean, number one, you don't have to join a fitness club or be part of a fitness club. You can do a lot of things on your own to stay physically fit, and just getting out there and moving, and eating right. That you know, nutrition is a big part of it too. But there's no simple way in terms of number of calories you take in, number of calories you burn out. That's how you maintain your weight and maintain your fitness. So.
Right. And I think Good questions. And Representative Hertas, you're next. But when the mention of square dancing, I just have to say nothing strikes fear in the heart of fifth graders than the notion of boys and girls having to maybe touch each other in phi ed class and square dance. So I remember that. Representative Hertas.
Well, thank you, Chair Loon and Representative Kreisha. I'm 10 years older than you. I thought the square dancing ended with my class. I think I remember Robert Preston's Go You Chicken Fat Go or something like that. We had to run. Representative Detmer, thanks for the bill. And, you know, our society is changing, and it's becoming more sedentary with all these electronic devices, and kids prefer to sit inside and play electronic games rather than go outside. I've had my neighbors argue with their kids, it's a beautiful day, get out of here. You know, actually take the equipment away from them. I would also recommend that they don't join the legislature because this is too sedentary. I've spent my entire career outside building houses and working, and coming here cost me 20 pounds. I got rid of it last summer, but I got 10 of it back. But I've been able to keep my weight about 10% of where I was in high school, and I bet you can still wear your letter jacket as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a good point there about the sedentary, not only of us here in the legislature, but students. You walk around communities now. And I grew up on a dairy farm, and in my first 6 years was in a one-room schoolhouse next to our farm, outdoor Biffies. And you look at what's going on now with our youth. You go around communities and look around in yards. How many tree houses do you see up in trees? I mean,
it's against zoning regulations.
Yeah. you just don't see kids playing outside and pick up baseball games or whatever it is. You just don't see them. And if we can get some of these standards in our schools and lifestyle things that students need to start planning on and being encouraged by professional staff and teachers, I think this can have a big impact on our young people. Thank you.
Thank you. I have one question, and either for Mr. Johnson or whoever wants to chime in. But I'm just wondering, it seems pretty clear there is a definite connection between physical activity and children's learning. I was touring one of my own schools, elementary school, and they were showing me something called Yoga Calm, which I've never heard of, and they had little kindergartners crawling on the floor in sort of a little obstacle course with words taped to the floor. Mm-hmm. As part of their learning to read, and also they used it actually for the kids who were kind of struggling to read and maybe had difficulty paying attention. And I'm wondering how much research there is on that and what is being provided to our teachers as part of maybe professional development to understand some of those connections and help work that into their classroom activities.
Madam Chair, that'd be fun watching that in the classroom. I bet that was fun. We, our classroom teachers at our school are really good. They use what we call Go Noodle, and it's an interactive based kind of game where they follow along. So it's projected, and it's on the projector, and the kids are kind of following along with the physical activity. And the physical activity part is really the part that helps our brain and helps our brain learn. And, of course, the physical activity is what's going to keep our weight down and keep us in good health. And I'm not sure if I'm answering your question here, but physical education class, we have to remember, is different than physical activity. You know, physical education class right now, we're teaching those skills, whether it be kicking to throwing to analyzing heart rates. Our high school students are developing their own fitness programs and then analyzing those fitness programs and goal setting. And so there's a lot of academia. There's a lot of important things that our students need to learn from us. But we highly encourage the physical activity. So as physical education teachers, we are encouraging, and it's kind of left up to us as far as my school goes. And we kind of give those resources when we can.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? And was there anyone else in the audience who wished to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none. Representative Detmer, final comment?
Well, thank you, and you know, I think we're all looking forward to this weekend, and it's supposed to be in the 60s tomorrow. If we all can get out and maybe start doing our yard work and getting out and getting some exercise, and if you see young people out playing, and you're walking by, just encourage them to continue to be out playing, and especially young kids. Because when we get into the structure of our schools and colleges, many times that having fun needs to also be encouraged there too. So, but thank you, committee members and Chair Loon, for allowing us to come in and present this. I think one of the most important bills we can present for our E-12 education curriculums. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Detmer renews his motion that House File 498 be re-referred to Ways and Means, but the Chair's intention today is to lay it over. And thank you all. Thanks for your testimony. All right. So we're going to do some informational hearings on a few bills, and the first is Representative Peterson, House File 12983.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I want to thank you for being willing to hear this bill. And I do have some testifiers here as well. And as they get set up, I'll just sort of set up the framework of the impetus behind this bill and what it does. As you know, we're kind of using a 1940s model of teaching. And today's student is a lot different than the 1940s student. Just, and if you have any kids at home, they have multiple things going on at once and things that drive me absolutely crazy, but that's how they learn today. So I think that we need to adapt our school districts to work for the students that we have today, for the 21st century student. And if you're going to do any innovation, I think you really have to look at our teachers. Our teachers are the ones that are closest to our students. They understand them. And lately, we've had a very top-down management style. We tell our teachers how to teach, when they teach, what they teach. And this is a bill that goes off of the site-governed schools and allows the school to be sort of a charter within the school district. And it allows students to stay in their community schools and yet have another choice or have another innovative model to look at. But we really need to empower the teachers to do that. And in essence, the teachers come up with a different type of model, and the school district administration and school board approve sort of a mini side union contract with those teachers because they need to deal with logistics of prep time and other things that don't work within the master contract. So this allows them to sort of have a side contract agreement, and then it has to be approved by everybody. It's currently been done in 13 states, and I want to. We do have a school that we really implemented in Lakeville Area Schools, and I'm going to move it on to our testifiers. So we have Dr. Lisa Snyder here from Lakeville Area Schools, and she can tell you a little bit more about Impact Academy, where we have a very innovative model.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm here to talk about teacher empowerment. And I actually have had a long career in education and have created many charter schools in Wisconsin primarily. But my real passion is around improving public education within a school district. And I have found with my colleagues that the best way to do that is by empowering a group of passionate teachers to redesign the school and really have a high level of ownership in the decision-making process. So in Lakeville Area Public Schools, 4 years ago, we really started promoting a culture of innovation. And right now, the couple of programs that everyone's abuzz about are all because of teacher empowerment. So whether it's the STEM Academy at Lakeville South, the Business Academy at Lakeville North, or our Shining Star Impact Academy, a K-5 model with a huge waiting list, it is all because a group of teachers wanted to create something. Now, that is very difficult to do within inside of a district without the help of something like this that could give a district a little bit of seed money we really have taken the last 3 years and tried to support this group of teachers that were creating this new elementary model, this 21st century model of education that really should be prevalent in all of our schools. We know internationally, whether you look at Finland, where they have the best and brightest teachers with high levels of autonomy, or you look at Japan, where they implement lesson study with groups of teachers to continually improve the educational offerings for students, that is the key to educational redesign, innovation, and better schools. So I'm here to advocate empowering our students within the context of a school district and supporting them as partners as we redesign education for our students. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Snyder.
Okay, thank you. And Madam Chair, my name is Louise Sundin, and I'm here representing the 4,500 teachers and educational assistants in Minneapolis. And I'm glad to be here again with Jim Bartholomew from the Business Partnership, because the last time we were together as partners, strange bedfellows, we invented the site-governed schools legislation that this builds on. So we're happy to be here together again. I want to provide a little larger context for this and start with a quote. To improve the quality of teaching, you need to improve the quality of the teaching job. If you really improve that job, you would attract good people, intelligent people, and you would keep them. So when you change the job, you change the outcome. That's from Richard Ingersoll from the University of Pennsylvania, and he does a lot of research that we rely on and whose work underscores our work, because you need to change the job in order to provide the opportunity to fix the teacher shortage that we have in this state and looming across the country. So that's where I'm going to go with this. So why do we care? It's because nearly half of the teachers are not teaching after the first 5 or 6 years, because universities and school districts can't even invest large amounts of money into training those new teachers, and then they're gone and they do something else because they're millennials, and they can and they do. And the professionals leave also because teaching is not yet a true profession. And so that means that they have little or no control or authority or autonomy over their own work. So the nearest thing I can think of to what we, when we had that kind of autonomy, was maybe back in the one-room schoolhouse. But education, unfortunately, organized itself after the auto industry until Saturn. And then Saturn changed all that, respecting workers, encouraging innovation, empowering teams to have pride in their creations. One Saturn worker told us, I was there 3 times, I'm a Saturnophile or something, told us on a visit to the plant, the reason I love working here is that I'm respected, not only for my hands and my head, but my heart. From an auto worker. So we all figured, how bad can that be? Teachers used to be respected for their minds and their hearts as they did what they loved to do, which was teach children. Now the experienced, the best and the brightest are leaving in droves because they don't have that modicum of respect, no opportunity for creativity and innovation, no support for their work, and no control, authority, autonomy over in their own classrooms. 2 days ago, and tomorrow also, I'm speaking to full assembly rooms of teachers who want out. They are not necessarily of pensionable age yet, but they want out. Just can't do it anymore, they tell me. This isn't what I came into teaching for, they say. And the young ones leaving early, the reasons they give are much the same, except they say not enough support and not enough freedom to do what I know I can do. So what are they talking about? Well, a couple of months ago, there was an elementary teacher in her classroom. 9 district administrators showed up stood around, and were they observing her teaching? No. Were they observing her creativity or her relationships with children or her ability to adjust individualized instruction? Not a chance. They were counting the minutes she was spending on reading and counting the minutes of where she was in her 15-minute pacing schedule. That's it. So you see what is happening to us and why they are leaving. Years ago, I was a 25-year vice president of the American Federation of Teachers, and Albert Shanker, the AFT president, who was a noted education leader and thinker, said a couple of things that I've never forgotten and repeat often, so you may have heard them from me before. He said, if teaching ever becomes reduced to pre-testing, record, testing, record, post-test, record, repeat, everybody and their half-sister thinks that they need to keep teachers right here under their thumb, then it will become nothing more than clerical work, and the people coming into teaching will no longer be the best and the brightest. I think that's where we are. He also said if we want better results, we should try to find a way to give groups of teachers the opportunity and support to start their own schools with groups of parents to try what they know works. Try research-based pedagogy. Try active learning. Try brain-based curriculum. Try whatever they know will work. So now, years later, here we are trying to dig out from ESEA turned NCLB with not just orders from headquarters, but orders from the feds, from the states, from districts, from superintendents, governing every minute of that pacing schedule. So if you've heard the results, and you have in this committee from superintendents and HR directors, in Minnesota, they can't find licensed teachers with a search party, particularly in greater Minnesota and in critical licensure areas. Universities are telling us they can't find classrooms to put student teachers in because it might harm the testing results. So we have in Minnesota a teaching demographic that is in the shape of an M. Now, I suppose that's appropriate for a Minnesota, but the teaching demographic we have is the first 5 years and then down in the middle and then the last 10 or 15 years, but nobody in the middle, because the early ones have left and the ones who are starting to leave are on the other end. Now, why is that bad? It's bad because Dr. Saunders' research says that teachers reach their highest level of productivity. For a teacher, productivity is how successful we are with students. Highest productivity in grade in year 10 to 12, and that remains a high plateau until after in their about mid-25th year or so. So this middle that is the highest productivity, we don't have, because they're gone or they're leaving. So professionally powered schools give teachers the power to be true professionals, to make decisions about not just what to teach and how to teach, but who will be their colleagues, how they promote their school, how they will evaluate each other, how they will pay for new technology. The decisions are endless, but the challenge is invigorating, inspiring. And the teams of educators are true colleagues and collaborators in creating, delivering, and deciding. So you have a great example just down the road. I think it's that way. You can't tell in the basement. Down University Avenue at University in Raymond of such a school, I'd suggest a field trip. They've been a teacher-powered school for 11 years. Check it out. It's not only what's best for kids, it's what's best for educators. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Sundin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Bartholomew with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I want to thank Representative Peterson for authoring the bill, and it's fun to be before you again with Ms. Sundin. The Business Partnership has been a longtime advocate for giving teachers greater autonomy to design the programs and services they believe will best help their students succeed. Not only is there a great deal of research supporting the role increased autonomy plays in student and school success, but we also see it in the high-performing schools we've recognized over the last 9 years. The handout we provided summarizes some of the research, both within the U.S. and on an international basis. And as you can tell, school autonomy is the common thread between all of them. Our support for House File 1283 is based in part on our experience working with the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. After the self-governed school law was expanded a few years ago, the MFT brought together some of their members who wanted the opportunity to design more effective instructional models in exchange for agreed-upon improvement in student performance. However, just like those who want to create a charter school, the Minneapolis teachers needed some support to develop plans for how a self-governed school would operate and for developing curriculum and instruction. Despite some wonderful ideas and a great deal of commitment, the lack of planning or startup funds proved to be a significant barrier. House File 1283 addresses this need. We believe giving teachers who want the opportunity and responsibility for designing more effective schools is something that will not only benefit students, but also teachers. Thank you. And in the future, at least, we'd hope you support House File 1283.
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Curtis Johnson. I'm with Education Evolving, which along with the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers and the Business Partnership and the Center for School Change, we're actively promoting those amendments in 2009. I want to be very brief and just deal with the disbelief side of this issue. I've been in many conversations over many years where people would say, well, that's a neat idea, having teachers take responsibility for a school, but who would really want to do it? And about a year ago, we commissioned a national survey and were astonished ourselves at the results. Nearly three-fourths of all teachers in this country think this is a good or a great idea, and a fifth of them are ready to do it tomorrow morning. We never knew this. So this bill essentially tests two propositions. It tests whether there really is enough interest among teachers to raise their hand, step up, and say, we want to take responsibility for a school. And it tests how many school boards and how many union presidents will jointly consent to this arrangement. We don't know until we try. This bill does not order anybody to do anything. It does not create any new mandates. It's simply an opportunity to just find out whether teachers will deliver the accountability that the public's looking for if you give them the authority that they've always wanted. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have any additional testifiers, Representative Peterson? Is there anyone else from the general public? All right. Mr. Nathan?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Nathan. I've been a public school teacher, administrator, PTA president, and advocate for public education for the last 45 years. I'll be brief. 45 years ago, literally, a group of teachers and parents came together in St. Paul to create a new option within the district. We had a small amount of startup funds. This bill speaks to startup funds. This is not a tail. This is a small amount of startup funds. I think that that's the first of 3 points I want to make. People from all over the United States and all over the world came to see that school because it was created by a group of parents and teachers because it was a K through 12 option. It did not cost more money to operate, just as the Lakeville program does not cost more money, which I think is a tribute to the district and to the teachers and to the teachers union that have worked out a way to use the teachers' ingenuity but not cost more money to do things differently. And one of the things that the modest superintendent didn't mention is that they have done really well, and she might want to comment briefly on the significant improvement in the kindergarten and first grade level in reading that's come out of that program. So the first is this doesn't create tails. The second is that it's enormous respect for teachers, and we all talk about the respect for teachers. This is an explicit affirmation that we ought to give teachers within districts the opportunity to create new options. The third and final point is that although there is a certain amount of money proposed, you could do a lot with a little. And so you may not want to fund at the level that's been initially proposed, but even $750,000 or $1 million, which is a lot of money, but much less than initially proposed, you could give some teachers around the state within districts the opportunity to do some important things. So thank you for consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Nathan. Is there any? Yes, come on down.
We're coming out of the woodwork.
That's okay.
My name is Ann Hobby, and I'm with Parents United for Public Schools. We have not had a chance in our office to really talk to parents about this yet, but there is a fair amount of buzz in our office and excitement. I embarrassed myself this morning by sending Representative Peterson research that was already mentioned up here. But we are research-based, and we're excited about the potential this would give to move back to a site-based model. Parents really feel like we've moved away from that in most schools, and I think that those things could go hand in hand. There's room for some parents to help with decision-making. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to testify? All right, with that, we're going to move to member questions, and I have a fairly long list. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank Representative Peterson for bringing this bill forward. As a teacher of 33 years, this excites me more than anything I've seen for a long time, and I believe it will make a huge difference. And I want to thank the superintendent, Dr. Schneider. Is that you hit the nail on the head so many times. I wanted to stand up and give you a standing ovation. this is amazing. It's so much, you know, as a teacher, I've felt like I've had a straitjacket on me for quite some time for my creativity. The straitjacket is the number of minutes you need to spend on things. And we all know as teachers that minutes aren't what matters. It's the guts of what we're teaching and how we're incorporating it and how we're exciting our students to get involved. So this is amazing, and I support it wholeheartedly.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know this has been successful in Milwaukee, and I think one in Boston, but how is it going nationally?
Representative Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mullery, I really can't speak to what's been going on nationally, but I can just tell you what's been happening in our schools, because that's closest to us, and maybe Dr. Snyder would like to comment on this as well. But, you know, we've been able to close the achievement gap. I'll let Dr. Snyder answer that question.
So this started out as a pilot program. It was a K-3. We expanded it to K-5. And as I mentioned, there's a huge waiting list for it, and we have a commitment from our board to expand it to a full-scale, full-school model 1 year from this fall. So it's very exciting. It's high demand from our parents because it's multi-age, so the curriculum is this way, so students can move through the curriculum at their own pace, and many of them are making a year and a half and 2 years of progress because we've taken away that grade level approach and that factory model approach and really personalized the learning, leveraging technology, leveraging flexible grouping, leveraging community service and service learning that really excites the kids and their own personal passions and beliefs, all packaged into one beautiful model that the teachers created. But 3 years ago when they came, well, 4 years ago when they came to me, they were leaving the district. They were looking for a charter authorizer. And I said to them, as a brand new superintendent in Lakeville, we need all of our schools to look like this. Stay here and create it. Let's go to the board. Let's get their support. Let's create this model. And people will come and want to see it and want to replicate it. And they've done that. They pushed up their sleeves and did that. And so after a very short time, what's really, really incredible is to see the results and to hear the anecdotal stories. But the best one I have right now, at the end of this year, they are the only kindergarten in our district, and we have 8 elementary schools with 4 sections of kindergarten in each one. They're the only kindergarten that are going to first grade with everyone reading above grade level. Every single student. There is no other classroom in our district, nor has there ever been, where you have sent a complete kindergarten class to first grade, ready to go, ready to learn above grade level. So we're really seeing that, the results of the model, and the satisfaction of our students and our parents are just very, very high as well. So we're very proud of the work.
Representative Mullery, follow-up?
Well, Madam Chair, apparently nobody knows the answer to the questions unless there's somebody in the audience, so I'll
Madam
just
Chair.
Let drop it. Under.
Actually, Madam Chair and Representative Mullery, Curtis Johnson just came down here and told me that this would be the first time that there's been some funding attached to these types of schools. And I just want to also explain that the school board made a commitment to address that initial seed money because we believed in the program that this would really help, and we wanted to take a risk and try something new. And the other things that we did is we got really creative on getting furniture donated and utilized parents to give us a better deal on some of the construction and things like that. And those types of things would probably still need to happen. But I think what this bill does is it's saying, you know what, we're gonna motivate you just a little bit more. And even $100,000 per school would really be a huge barrier for really school boards to say, okay, I got a little bit of seed money here. I don't have to take away another opportunity over here to address it. So this is innovative in the fact that apparently the other schools that are doing it did it, on their own.
Madam Chair,
Representative Mullery.
Not a question, but maybe Mr. Johnson could get us information if he knows about national use of this and success or failure or whatever later. Or apparently he's there.
Mr. Johnson.
Representative, the best way to take a deep dive in this is go to teacherpowered.org. Teacherpowered all run together. You'll get all the context, all the history. You'll get the statistics about the number of schools around the country that have organized this way. There are about 60 in total. They're scattered all over the country. But this would be, and maybe the committee is tired of Minnesota being first, but this would be the first, as Representative Peterson said, legislature to actually invest in the planning and startup for the creating of new teacher-powered schools. Most of them happened in other ways.
All right, thank you. And if members didn't hear that, Mr. Johnson shared a website with information, teacherpowered, all as one word, .org. All right. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a co-author on this bill, and it's a bipartisan co-authorship, I want it noted. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the co-authors, it's a good bill, and it really speaks to my soul. Mm-hmm. However, as a teacher, I do have a couple of questions. My friend Louise brought up Al Shanker, and when he was here 20-some years ago, what he created with Amber Reichgott Young and Ken Nelson and a bunch of stakeholders was the charter school legislation. And which I also, fully and completely support. And that's teacher-based and teacher-empowered. Mm-hmm. That's a very positive thing, and I think we've seen some very positive things even within, especially probably within the traditional districts, a move to more kid-centered education as opposed to adult-centered education. This is a question for you. Why would you choose to stay under the umbrella of a district where the superintendent, and I'm going to apologize ahead of time, where the principal can meddle, and then I'm going to tell you a very, very fast story, meddle with the process as opposed to a separate, really freeing organization of a charter school? Why not just do the independent charter school as opposed to this umbrella where these people can meddle? And then can I just very briefly tell you a very quick story? My friend and former colleague was here. He just left, Bradley Blue. And we were recruited to teach at Olson Middle School in Minneapolis. And we were, the principal recruited us and took us and said, you can do anything you want to do. So we're like, oh, yeah, I'm so there. And we had a team of four teachers, and we were off the grid. And we had the kids for 3 years, and the principal got consistently mad at us to the end of eighth grade, where I was the only one that could go have a conversation with her, and it's because I'm so nice. But but I was the only one. They'd send me down. I'd be the emissary to go try and make peace. But we used very unorthodox methods. We included exercise during the day. We did relaxation on the floor with the kids prior to tests, and then how to do a relax in your chair. We moved from the floor and guided imagery. I mean, we did single gender class. We were off the grid. We brought parents in. We rearranged kids all the time to keep them. These are middle school kids, from clicking out. And doing. I mean, we were on the cover of Time magazine, in fact, as a middle school that worked. We had the basic skills test at the time, and at the end of eighth grade, our kids took the Minnesota basic skills test, whatever it was at the time. And this was 87-89% free and reduced lunch. We delivered scores that rivaled Edina's. The other eighth grade team, not so much. But they weren't doing what we were doing. But they could go talk to the principal, okay? All four teachers left. We all bid out after delivering scores like that because of the meddling. And we all went separate places. And it was a heck of a team. And Brad Blue was on that team with me. He just took off and just left the room. But why would you... I found it personally frustrating to have to deal with administration, to have to deal with all this... And it's not that I didn't want to share what we were doing, or I mean, I was playing by the so-called rules under the umbrella, but it was just very difficult working within that framework. Why would you stay in a district? Why in the world would you stay in a district when you could go out, and there is funding for startups for charters, although the MDE is making it as difficult as possible.
Madam Chair and Representative.
Mr. Johnson.
Partial answer to your question is the story you tell about frustration has been repeated all over the state for years. We could bring you evidence of people mm-hmm. who tried to do this, got frustrated, hit a wall, and decided to go the charter route. And if Julene Oxton were here, the lead teacher in the Impact Academy that Dr. Snyder's talking about, they were headed in the same direction. They were going to organize a charter school. Mm-hmm. But they said before they took that last step, they'd go talk to the new superintendent. And she said, yes, why should you have to do that? Why don't we do it inside the district? And they were astonished because it was the first time they'd ever heard yes from a superintendent. So it is difficult. We've talked to dozens of teachers who've been trying to do this. The number one reason that stops them from doing it inside the district is there's no financial support for the planning and startup, like the charters have. So the intent of this bill is to create a program roughly comparable to what charters get in planning money and startup money to get going. And it tests those two propositions we're talking about. It goes directly to your frustration.
And Madam Chair?
Ms. Sundin.
Louise Sundin, again, I did quietly whisper in her ear that I would be happy to answer the question if Representative Slocum ever stopped asking it. But
you two are friends.
Yes, yeah, we are. Yeah, we are. The three things. One is that there can be contractual language. Secondly, there is something nationally called a reciprocal obligations agreement that we as national leaders negotiated with, interestingly enough, I thought it was, some of the early reform gurus like Chubb and Moe. So this is a broadly accepted opportunity for a school district and a group of teachers to sign this agreement. Now, we're also trying to figure out if this agreement goes awry, then what? And of course, the then what, we do have some ideas. We're working it out. Third thing is, just because a school is a charter school doesn't mean that they are teacher-led, teacher-empowered, teacher-nothing. They can be You know, some of them, as far as teachers are concerned, they have more teacher churning and more teacher abuse than many others. So that's why the Guild, which is the charter school authorizer that I'm chair of the board of, has as our goal actually empowering teachers in the schools that we authorize. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, actually, we've had these kinds of schools since 1985, because that's when Minnesota started moving in that direction. And Representative Davney, who authored the 2009 legislation that this now is amending? Do you recall? I know it was someone on your side of the aisle.
Word I'm getting is John Benson.
Yes, that's who it was. It was, yes. Because then I amended it further later on when I returned, and thank you, yes. So, you know, so this can happen, and when I look at this map, Minnesota is probably the state that has the most clusters of teacher-empowered. So it's going on, and I realize the concern here is for funding or for startup money, but... you know, again, we need to get the word out if in fact, teachers don't realize they can do this. But we've heard great testimony now from Dr. Snyder from Lakeville, who's really done a great job. But, you know, this is not brand new for those who are new here. This has been around for a while. In 2009, as Representative Davney affirmed, was former Representative John Benson from Edina's creation, taking off from what we had done in the 2000s, earlier 2000s, with site-based. So then we went to district and teacher-empowered in 2009, and then further have seen this evolvement. So this is really good. And Dr. Snyder, thank you for being an innovator and going ahead and doing this without the seed money, because, you know, that's a salute to what you saw as a need to address what the parents and students wanted in your district. And so I wish we could get the word out to all districts that, you know, if you feel this way, there's law. We don't need to add to it. It's there. Thank you.
Madam Chair, just one follow-up, Representative. John Benson is on the board of the Minneapolis or the Guild of Public Charter Schools, so we're still making use of his leadership.
And one little postscript to Representative: the majority of those teacher-powered schools in Minnesota did what Representative Slocum implied. They went the charter route because there was no support to do it inside the district.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. You know, again, a option for some districts that could do wonders for the kids and for a lot of futures. Earlier, we had the thing with the you know, disparities, which showed a lot of you know, lower funded. Well, many of those are in actually my district, but Byron, which is one of the lower ones. I've often been asked why, if you're one of the bottom funded per pupil, why have you had success with the Intel Math Award, the Blue Ribbon High School, etc. Well, part of it was, during this discussion, was we've empowered the teachers when they said, they looked out for math text and said, these are pretty poor, the quality isn't available. They created their own curriculum. They utilized new technology sources, etc. They came together and did it because that was the best solution for the kids. And so while it isn't exactly the model, but much of the success, and there are other examples of the different grade levels of where they gave the teachers, and, you know, in partnership with parents, and they redid things to make it work. So that's how they addressed, you know, the needs for their district. So I support this because I've seen glimpses of it in a very successful school district. And, you know, again, it's not a silver bullet, but let the people have the keys to the car and take it for a spin, and hopefully the
local kids will be better off for it.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is answered.
Thank you. All right. Representative Peterson, anything final you want to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, thank you again for listening to this bill, and thank you for the comments. And that is true. This is in current statute. Maybe tweaks it just a little bit, but truly it is about that seed money to really give the reasons for school districts to take the extra work. And by no means does this cover the entire initial startup cost. There's going to have to still be a commitment from the teachers, the administration, and the school board. But I do think it's something to help move Minnesota forward and really do some great work for kids. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I see this is informational only. I'd love to get it into the omnibus bill, but I'm not quite sure how we go forward with that.
I think it's beneficial for the committee to hear the testimony on it, and so I wouldn't be constrained by that. So.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to start with House File 250.
All right.
House File 250 directs the districts to notify parents and students when you have someone acting in the capacity of a school counselor who's really not a licensed school counselor. In many of our districts, we have deans who act as school counselors. Deans do not have to be licensed. In fact, they don't even have to be educators or have to have a college degree. And in some districts, especially small districts, you'll have parents who will be helping students to do their applications for getting into college and that sort of thing. They're not licensed, they're not trained to do it, and they don't have all of the information. So all this bill does is ask that districts who have people acting in the capacity of a counselor who are not licensed counselors, that the parents and students be notified. Very simple.
All right, very well. Any testifiers?
No.
No, okay. Is there anyone?
I wish I had Ms. Goodchild to come up and talk about counselors, but that's for another day.
I must say she was amazing, and I took note of that as she was talking about the numbers of counselors. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 250? All right. You're true to your word, Representative Newton. You told me 5 minutes, so
promise.
Very good. Thank you. All right. So you want to talk about
House File 1134, Madam.
Yes. I was just going to see if any other members had questions, but all right. Pretty straightforward bill. All right, House File 1134.
And this also is a very straightforward bill. It's sort of the reverse of what you traditionally see with PSEO, where you have students moving from the high schools over to a community college or university to take their courses. This would permit the licensing of university or college teachers to be able to be licensed as by the licensure department so that they can teach in our high schools. And specifically, I'm thinking of a case in Anoka-Hennepin. We have what's called the STEP school, which is a secondary technical education program. It's really a tech school. But in that school, it's joined with our Anoka Technical College. And we have students, for example, who are taking nursing programs. They're doing PSEO. They're taking the nursing programs, but we don't have teachers, for example, biology teachers, who are available to teach that class for that small group of students. So we'd be able to move teachers from Anoka-Ramsey Community College, which is aligned with the technical college, to come into the STEP school and teach the course in the STEP school. So what it's doing, rather than having the students move to the community college, it's having the teachers being able to come to the classrooms and teach the class in the classroom and to be licensed as long as they've had 5 of the last 10 years teaching that subject area and working in that subject area, that they would be automatically licensed by the state. And that's that.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify? Right, I see someone coming down. Representative Dabney, did you want to ask your question now?
I can wait until after.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Cindy Christ of the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. We do have some concerns about this bill. I apologize, I haven't spoken with Representative Newton because we just saw yesterday evening that this was added to the agenda. Before I started working for MACDA, I worked for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and part of my portfolio was PSEO and concurrent enrollment. And when we were challenged about how our faculty could teach courses through PSEO in high schools, we always said that, you know, they were teaching there as college university faculty, delivering college university courses just as they would on a college campus, same content, same student assignments, same assessments. And they were only teaching students who had been selected or identified as meeting college university expectations, requirements to take those courses. So it was just a matter of geography where they were teaching the course. There were still college university faculty teaching college courses. But obviously this would significantly broaden the scope. And I just want to remind you of a couple of things. When teachers are licensed, they've completed programs that demonstrate, and therefore they have demonstrated, that they've met all 10 of the standards of effective practice that are laid out in statute and rule. The first of those is content, and certainly the substance of content they would be well prepared to teach in a high school. Some issues like student misconceptions and student conceptual frameworks perhaps would go beyond what a college university faculty would be prepared to teach. Let's use chemistry as an example, or biology, since Representative Newton used that. But there are 9 other standards of effective practice, and I won't name them all or give examples in all of them, but I'll just give you a couple of examples. One of them is student learning, and part of that involves the developmental understanding of the developmental progression of learners. This is something a college or a university faculty member would not have had unless they had previously been, let's say, a high school teacher. Under diverse learners, one of the many items there is one that you directed be included, and that is a knowledge of Minnesota-based American Indian tribal government, history, language, and culture. Another item that's there, I believe at your direction, and certainly with everyone's support, under the standard of effective practice called instructional strategies, is to understand Minnesota's graduation standards. I don't believe that's a body of knowledge that college university members would have. If you look at other pages on this bill that outline standards, you'll see at the bottom of page 2, and I was hoping Representative Erickson would be here because I thought she might be able to jog my memory. Maybe some of the others of you will. The year when there were some additions made dealing with scientifically based reading instruction, including test items assessing candidates' knowledge, skill, and ability in comprehensive scientifically based reading instruction. Again, that's something that college and university faculty wouldn't have. Or in page 3, last year, based on legislation that was enacted, added knowledge and preparation and teaching English language learners. So if somebody, this let's say, teacher who could teach biology, if they're awarded a standard license in biology, they therefore would have permission to teach all sciences, grades 5 through 12, and biology in grades 9 through 12. So I think it's clear, I hope it's clear, that this is a set of expectations and a scope of practice far beyond what a college or university faculty member would have. That's not saying anything negative about their knowledge of the subject they're teaching, but simply that this would be a body of knowledge far beyond what most of those college university faculty would have.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the author. If I got my act together, I might have offered an amendment to require MinSCU to hire licensed K-12 teachers ahead of people with master's degrees that they normally hire, master's or above, to parallel this. Mm-hmm. Why not do that? Why not have licensed high school teachers? Why not require MinSCU to hire, first of all, licensed teachers to teach at the college level?
Madam Chair, and I don't know the answer to that. I mean, why would you do that at the University of Minnesota or any other MinSCU college? You're
you have people who have a minimum of a master's degree in a content area teaching a class. And, you know, to the general lady's comments, what we're asking is that these teachers teach only PSEO students who they would normally teach in the MNSCU setting itself, except that they're going to be being able to use the facilities of the high school or a technical school. So I'm somewhat perplexed, and maybe it's a good thing that this thing isn't ready for prime time, Madam Chair, that I should talk with Representative Dabney and the lady here to make sure. But, I mean, that's the intent of this, is that when you have class sizes so small that you don't have a high school teacher who is available to teach the class, and yet you do have a MNSCU teacher who could come in and teach the class in the high school setting. That's essentially what we're looking for.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Newton, my point is I've got 17 years of teaching experience. Mm-hmm. I've got a master's in education and a master's in public affairs, and I'm not considered qualified. And 15 years of legislative experience, and I'm not considered qualified by the MNSCU system to teach a Minnesota government class.
Yeah. Yes.
I guess I'm of a strong belief that we teach kids content, not content to kids. And frankly, the further you go in education, master's and then PhD, you actually narrow the focus of your study, not broaden it. And someone with a PhD in electrical engineering isn't necessarily qualified to teach math to a high school student, because we don't know that they have the areas of effective practice that Ms. Chris went to, nor the orientation to work with kids, which is fundamentally what, and most importantly, what they're doing first. But your bill would suggest granting them a license, which then would allow them to teach anyone, not just PSEO students, in any district, any school in the state. And I just think we're missing the focus on the student with this. And I don't get the economics. If you can't afford to put a licensed biology teacher in a classroom, then I'm not sure how you can afford to put a licensed or a non-licensed biology teacher in a classroom. Sorry, bud.
No, Madam Chair and Representative Dabney, I see your point. But, I mean, that's just the nature of the college system, too, is that you have someone who has a degree, usually a master's degree or higher, in the content area teaching that specific class. For example, I do have a master's in international relations, and I teach world politics. I just can't teach every area of government, but I can teach world politics. So, I mean, we, as you say, as we go further with our degrees, we get more narrow in scope and more limited in the classes we can teach. But, you know, for this specific case, it's Anoka Hennepin has large classes. We going to be laying off some 250 teachers if the budget stays the way it is, and with large classrooms, and we don't have, for example, a biology teacher that we can free up from a class of 40 to teach a class of 9 or 10 PSEO students. Yeah, but however, we do have college faculty who can teach that class, as long as we've got the facility available to do it. So that's the intent of this, and Madam Chair, I'll work with Representative Dabney and Ms. Christ and try to get this a little bit better, because I do see your point. I see that this would open it up to all classes, and that certainly isn't the intent of this bill.
Okay. Thank you. So I have Representative Mullery and Quam on the list. Just pointing out that, just remember, this is informational only, and I know members are getting a little antsy, as is the chair, so let's try to keep it concise. Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe I'm sorry if I missed that it was only PSEO, but that was my concern. The other concern is the word must. I think maybe they should be able to analyze something more on the issue. But as far as the testifier, I can just say that in my high school experience, by far the two best teachers I ever had were both never had an education course, and they were vastly better than all the certified ones. So it, just the certification is not much in my experience. But if it's only PSEO, and if you take out the must, then I don't have a problem.
Representative Plum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the intent is to allow for better cooperative effort between MNSCU and the schools. With PSEO and these other options of taking college credit before, I can envision where scheduling-wise you may have some sections for convenience of the students and the community at a high school site, some of them at the MNSCU site, but you know, allowing for some flexibility. Yes, it does need clarification and more focused effort to do that. And you know, I'm a physicist. I taught you know, college math students. You know, it wasn't quite my area, but close enough. But my intent in supporting the idea is to foster that cooperation, because there are campus sites where if we can better integrate the college and the high schools, I think that'll be a good thing for the students. We just have to make sure that when we do it, we don't have a unintended oops. And that's probably why we're informational as opposed to possible inclusion.
Ms. Sundin, did you wish to offer testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make it really quick. I just wanted to...
Just please state your name.
Louise Sundin, and I don't know who I'm representing with these comments. Which hat I'm going to wear. So I know that there... Thank you. There are classes in the basement of the Virginia High School that are laser wood machining that are taught by one of the Northeast Technical Colleges. It can be done. But the only reason I wanted to follow up is that there was a task force, MDE, one of the many MDE task forces last year on career and tech ed. And I know there was tremendous frustration in that task force, because when the issue of licensure came up, then, of course, the K-12 people would present, Representative Dabney, your opinion, and then the career tech ed people from MNSCU would pipe up and say, oh, well, no, there's no flexibility with our licensure here. So the two sides were both saying, oh, well, no, there's no room for flexibility here. So I just want to say that I appreciate that Representative Newton has brought the issue forward, because I do think there needs to be discussion. I do think that maybe narrowing to career in tech ed or something might help. But there is a discussion, I think, that if we are trying to foster, as I think we all are, more partnership between K-12 and our, particularly our community and technical colleges, we need to have this discussion and see if we can't be a little more creative than, oh, no, we can't do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dabney?
I'll be brief. Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, maybe this is a space, hearing Representative Quam talking from a more greater Minnesota perspective and Representative Newton from a more metro perspective, where we should be looking at things like broadband, and where if you've got eight kids looking for a math class, where either you're using broadband and technology for the local MNSCU teacher on-site at MNSCU to be delivering that content, so you're getting the college-level piece, perhaps with an experienced paraprofessional in the room for the relationships and management and that sort of thing, and utilizing some of those modern technologies, or a hybrid class, you know, thinking outside of the box, you know, that or the two silos you described, Ms. Sundin, that could be a resolution for this without hopefully some of the oops but still allowing the access, because you know we've talked quite a bit about concurrent enrollment here and the need for rigor and opportunity for those classes for a whole spectrum of kids, but there are the challenges that we sometimes run into, and hopefully we can deal some of that with some of that in the omnibus bill, but also things like broadband in the jobs bill and the e-technology for libraries and the like here can also be a part of a package that looks at this issue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I don't want to drag this out, but you make a very valid point, Representative Dabney, and I think eventually we can move to that sort of system, but like everything else, it's funding and then that degree of cooperation between our college systems and our schools, our K-12 system. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. All members and the testifiers today, I thank you for your attention. And with that, the committee is adjourned.